Damien Carrick with you. Welcome to The Law Report. Do judges influence public opinion? If a court makes a ruling on a hot-button social issue, can that shift the national conversation? First, though, new research that suggests jurors in sex abuse trials do not become prejudiced against an accused if they hear evidence from more than one complainant. At the recent Sydney launch of the findings, the Commission's chair, Justice Peter McClellan, summed up the predicament faced by complainants.
Child sexual abuse offences are generally committed in private. With no eyewitnesses in many cases, there will be no medical or scientific evidence capable of confirming that abuse has occurred. It is likely that the only direct evidence will come from the complainant. Where the only evidence of the abuse is the complainant's evidence, it can be difficult for the jury to be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that the alleged offence occurred. The jury is effectively considering the account of one person against the account of another.
But what happens if a number of people come forward with similar complaints? Should those complaints be heard together in a joint trial? Justice Peter McClellan and his team commissioned research to look at how juries respond to hearing evidence from multiple complainants. Professor Jane Goodman-Delahunty is an experimental psychologist and lawyer. She's based at Charles Sturt University. She's the lead author of the research. She says that sometimes joint trials are allowed, but sometimes, as in the case of brother John Dennis Maguire, there are separate trials.
He was a dormitory master and teacher at a Catholic school where he seemed to target young boys who were probably in the age range, sort of 10 to 11 years old, who were homesick. And he would befriend them and engage in a grooming kind of process that led to sexual assaults. And there were a series of boys over a number of years who had this experience with their dorm master. And ultimately, when charges were brought against him, you know, because these events happened, I think, in the 1980s and so on. So many years later, as is typical in these kinds of cases, the victims filed complaints. And the defense lawyers were very successful in requiring that all the trials be held separately. And there were 8 separate trials in which there was not a single conviction, even though the evidence did seem to demonstrate this kind of pattern. And then ultimately, last year, the first conviction occurred after, you know, about 8 or 9 years of litigation. So now he is in jail.
A few months ago, one of the 8 original complainants spoke to the Royal Commission about those 8 separate trials.
To this day, I cannot understand why there were 8 separate trials against Maguire when all complainants were from the same school, all abused within a 3-year period, most of whom were abused in the same year. I found the separate trial process disappointing because it protected the offender over the complainants. Maguire's word against one victim is very different to Maguire's word against 8 victims. Had it been a joint trial, there would have been less restrictions on evidence and the case against Maguire would have been more convincing. I generally believe that the outcome of Maguire's trials would have been different if they were heard jointly.
Of course, on the flip side, there's a fear that if evidence from a number of complainants are heard together in one trial, then jurors will be prejudiced against the accused. They'll assume that where there's smoke, there's fire, and the accused is guilty because so many people have come forward.
Well, yes, there's a well-developed and traditional body of legal doctrine, both in statute and in common law, that judges may rely on in requiring that the trials be run separately rather than jointly because of the assumption that there will be what is called, you know, unfair prejudice to the accused in various kinds of ways. And in looking at that doctrine, we distinguish 3 kinds of types of prejudice that were thought to arise if juries were exposed to this evidence. And so first one is that the juries will be overwhelmed by the cumulative number of witnesses or the cumulative number of counts against one particular defendant and therefore just not analyze them separately and jump to the conclusion that the defendant is guilty. You know, and the second type is called characterological prejudice, where the idea is that, you know, if somebody has behaved in a certain way on one occasion, they're bound to have done it again. And therefore, again, you just do a sort of a shortcut of reasoning rather than look at the individual claims. And the third type is because there are more witnesses who have similar kinds of facts to talk about, that the juries won't be able to keep the facts straight, that they will conflate them and, you know, and convict the defendant based on a confusion or a muddle of the evidence.
Mm. Now, to complicate matters, often it's not just a question of whether or not there should be a joint trial involving charges involving a number of different victims. Sometimes there might be only charges relating to one complainant, but prosecutors will seek to admit evidence from other witnesses that speaks to a pattern of behaviour or a tendency. That's also an issue, isn't it?
That is. And so it's not exclusively in a joint trial that this sort of evidence could be helpful. For example, in the Maguire case, some of the other victims had been allowed to give evidence about what they had experienced, even in a separate trial. If that evidence were allowed in as tendency evidence, then that would also have provided a similar picture to the jury.
Professor Jane Goodman-Delahunty, you are the lead author of new research looking at how juries deal with these sorts of cases. What were the parameters of your research?
Well, the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse asked us to investigate this issue and to do that in the form of a set of experimental mock jury trials with over 1,000 mock jurors. And they came together, didn't know each other. They watched a video trial that was realistically portraying one of these typical kinds of cases. And it was professionally acted with a real district court judge playing the role of the judge and real barristers who are experienced with these kinds of cases playing the Crown prosecutor and the defense barrister. And then at the end of the video trial, these groups of jurors deliberated to a verdict. And we had 90 different juries do this. And while they were deliberating, we did what you can't do in a real trial. So we were able to audio tape and videotape their discussion and study their reasoning so that we could get a picture of whether or not they were, in fact, susceptible to those three types of prejudice, the accumulation of the facts or just the overwhelming numbers of the evidence or the character prejudice.
So you had the 1,000 mock jurors sitting down to watch a two-hour video of a mock trial. Were they all watching the same video?
No, it was a controlled experiment in which we compared four basic kinds of trials. A separate trial with just a single complainant, then a second trial where the same complainant provided information about additional uncharged acts that form context or relationship evidence between he and the defendant. And then a third trial in which other victims of the same defendant testified as witnesses in the form of tendency evidence. And then finally, a joint trial in which both the first complainant as well as the other two who gave the tendency evidence were also co-complainants. And so the total number of charges varied from two charges from a single complainant to a total of six charges when there were multiple complainants.
You ran these 90 mock trials involving 1,000 mock jurors. What did you find in terms of the effect of this kind of these different forms of evidence on jurors?
What we saw was that the conviction rate was higher in the separate trial with the relationship evidence than just in the basic separate trial. And then when the tendency evidence and the joint trials were run, the conviction rate increased accordingly. But it was very tightly connected to the assessments of the credibility of the complainants.
So in terms of whether or not this was prejudicial to an accused, what's the heart of your finding?
Was that there was in fact no unfair prejudice from the tendency evidence being admitted or from a joint trial.
How do you measure for this? I mean, were all the allegations and were all the testimonies, were they all equally strong?
No, we varied the evidence specifically to try to see whether a weak trial or a weak case, you know, would get a free ride along with stronger cases. And what we saw in the case of the weakest complainant, where there were contradictions in the evidence surrounding his claim, and he didn't have any support from any independent witnesses, we found that the jurors focused on those areas, and there were many acquittals. So the juries distinguished between the counts based on the strength of evidence. There were logical distinctions made in assessing the evidence.
Lead author Professor Jane Goodman Delahunty from Charles Sturt University. We have a link to her study at the Law Report page on the RN website. Nick Cowdery was the New South Wales Director of Public Prosecutions from 1994 to 2011. He's taken a keen interest in this new research.
Well, for those like me who have great confidence in the jury system for criminal trials, it was really a vote of confidence, a vote of support, subject to the limitations of the study itself, of course, but an indication that juries are actually doing what we expect them to do, which is very encouraging. Not everybody will take it that way, but I certainly do. Because it demonstrated that juries are able to do what they are directed to do, and that is to deal with each individual charge that is before them against each individual alleged offender on the basis of the evidence that is properly admissible to support that charge, and not to be confused or biased or persuaded by information that is not strictly usable in relation to that particular matter.
Mm. You are, of course, a former prosecutor. I would imagine that defence lawyers would be a lot more sanguine or sceptical about this.
Well, the discussion is now beginning, of course, into just what the report means, what are the limitations that need to be applied, what are the generalisations that can be drawn from it. You have to bear in mind, of course, that this was a study that was based on mock jurors, mock trials. The trials that were presented to them were presented to them by video recordings rather than oral evidence. There was not all of the hoopla that goes with the day-to-day conduct of a trial, and of course it was all compressed into a fairly short time frame. And there are criticisms, I think, that can legitimately be made about people who are put into a mock situation, that is, not a real case. But nevertheless, it was quite an extensive trial, and the methodology of the review was certainly very rigorous. So I think we're entitled to give some weight to the findings that come from it. But as you say, there probably will be arguments on the other side from people who look at the whole process of jury trial in a rather different light.
Well, let's come back to how the research might be used in a moment. What's the legal test for determining whether a joint trial can be held or whether there should be separate trials?
Well, it's essentially whether or not the allegations are sufficiently similar, sufficiently connected to justify that course. To give a very simple example, you might have somebody who is charged with 25 housebreaking offences. The evidence seems to indicate that this person has been on a stint over a couple of weeks, breaking into houses in a particular area, and the evidence is prima facie anyway, pointing to him being the offender. It is much more beneficial for all kinds of reasons that all of those offences be dealt with in the one trial. You do run into some difficulties with particularly sexual assault offences, and this has been recognised in the authorities over time in this country and elsewhere. Where you have, for example, one person charged with, say, three sexual assault offences against three different victims, the view may be taken more easily that for a jury dealing with one of those sets of allegations to hear about similar conduct alleged to have been committed against somebody else by the same person may have an unfairly prejudicial effect on the way in which the jury comes to judge that first count. This is one of the areas where this study probed very deeply and, in fact, concluded that we don't have any reason to be concerned. The juries are able to make the separation that's required, and not unfairly prejudice the accused. But it has been the case, and unless the mood of the courts changes, or unless legislation comes in, it's probably likely to be the case that there will be some diffidence about allowing joint trials to proceed where there are other allegations of sexual assault.
But sometimes they do happen. So, for instance, the case of John Dennis Maguire, he was the Maris brother. There were something like 8 different trials, acquitted or hung jury, and then finally on the 9th or the 8th, he was found guilty and sentenced. But there have been other cases, for instance, Hey Dad TV actor Robert Hughes. There were, I think, charges related to a number of girls, now women, and there was also tendency evidence from a number of other witnesses, so evidence relating to similar allegations but not connected to actual charges. They do actually sometimes allow joint trials and tendency evidence. What's the test for allowing that to come in? You need this striking similarity. And what else?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. The circumstances where the joint trials can proceed are circumstances where the evidence admissible in relation to one of the sets of allegations is also admissible in relation to the other sets of allegations. And that most commonly comes about, as you've mentioned, in the case of what we call tendency or coincidence evidence. This used to be called similar fact evidence, which actually gives you a better layman's description of what is going on. The test is that the evidence must have very high probative value. It must be strongly capable of demonstrating that what happened, either in the case of tendency evidence, was the result of a tendency, as the word implies, of this person to act in this particular way, or, so far as coincidence is concerned, strongly probative evidence. What happens in relation to those categories of evidence is that if the prosecution is seeking to rely upon them, notice must be given to the defence, and that very high level of probative value must be found by the court before it's admitted. But that's a situation where, even in sexual assault cases, there can be joint trials because all of that kind of evidence becomes admissible in the proof of all of the charges that are running.
Do you think that we currently have the right balance?
I think we probably do. I know you've referred to the fact that I was a prosecutor, and that's quite true, but prosecutors try to be fair, and prosecutors try to ensure that there's no unfair prejudice that arises to the accused in the course of a criminal trial.
Coming back to the research which was recently released of Jane Goodman-Delahunty, the Royal Commission asked for this research to be done. How do you think it will be used?
Well, the Royal Commission wants this to be the beginning of a conversation around the country. And I think there are indications that that's happening. The fact that I'm here on your program would seem to be one. It will be reporting, I gather, probably around September on criminal justice issues, which will include this question of juries and the matters that are in this report.
Is it likely that that interim report will include a series of preliminary recommendations about whether there should be or shouldn't be changes to the law in this area?
I think the indications are yes, that it will, that they will digest the report and all of the subsequent discussions that come from it and submissions that might be made in relation to it, and try to formulate a set of recommendations for national adoption.
Changes to legislation, is that what we're talking about?
Probably, because if good, well-considered legislation is put through Parliament that addresses all of the issues of principle that arise and the practical matters also that need to be taken into account, that's the surest and the clearest and the most definite way of getting it done. And there are precedents for all the jurisdictions in Australia, and there are 9 jurisdictions that we're talking about, to adopt more or less uniform legislation in respect of matters. So that would be the best hope.
And as somebody who generally supports the current status quo, would you have concerns about changes to the procedures which sent the pendulum too far in favour of joint trials?
Yes, I would. And the reason is the issue of fairness and the problems of unfair prejudice arising to accused people in the course of their trials. We have to guard very strongly against that. The first duty of any criminal court is to ensure that the proceedings before it are fair. If we have legislated procedures in place, it makes it easier then for the judges to follow what is prescribed in a fair way without having to impose their own individual assessments of what might be fair in the particular circumstances. It helps them to guide their discretion, and I think that can be a very useful outcome.
Nick Cowdery, the New South Wales Director of Public Prosecutions from 1994 to 2011. He's now a professor at both UNSW and Sydney University. I did approach a number of defence barristers to get their perspective on these complex issues. They weren't available. But no doubt we'll be revisiting this issue when the Royal Commission releases its consultation paper on criminal justice issues a little later this year. I'm Damien Carrick and this is the Law Report on RN Radio Australia, ABC News Radio and on the ABC Radio app. And we're also tweeting at Law Report RN and at Damien_Carrick. Let's now shift gear and look at a very different type of legal research. It asks the question, to what extent do court rulings influence public opinion? Do court decisions actually shift the way we think about complex hot-button social issues? Malcolm Langford is an Australian who works in Norway. He's an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Oslo. His research involved focus groups of 3,000 Norwegians.
What we used was the Norwegian Citizen Panel, and we had groups of around 300 each that got different information. And the first study that I conducted looked at the criminalisation of prostitution in Norway. And it's a piece of legislation in 2009 which made it illegal to purchase sexual services. And there was, you know, slight, you know, majority support for that legislation at the time, and it's sort of grown up to around 65% support over the last 5 or 6 years. At the same time, there's a very interesting judgment from the Canadian Supreme Court, which found a roughly similar piece of legislation was unconstitutional because it didn't respect the personal security rights of sex workers. When you have criminalisation of sex work, you may take more risks as a sex worker, you may be more likely to inform police of dangers because you're worried about being arrested. And so on these grounds, they actually struck down a relatively similar piece of legislation. So what I wanted to find out was what happens when these different groups get different information about courts and their judgments on criminalisation of prostitution. So the first group just got the reason, if we can call it that, and just said the first group got a bit of information. People say that personal security rights of sex workers are threatened when sex work is criminalised. And then we looked at how people responded in the intensity of their support for the criminalisation law. The next group then just got the information that the European Court of Human Rights could strike down this legislation, period. Then we looked at what the spectrum of views were. Then we moved on and we had the European Court of Human Rights could strike down this legislation because it violates the personal security rights of sex workers. And then we repeated the same for the Norwegian Supreme Court and, in fact, for the Canadian Supreme Court to see what were the impacts on Norwegian citizen views.
One group were told that, look, similar legislation had been struck down in Canada for this very reason.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what did you find?
Well, surprisingly, all of those three courts had the same effect on public opinion. There was around a sort of 10 to 20% variation across the spectrum, but in all of those cases, support for the law fell from around 65% to just under 50%. Regardless of whether it was the Norwegian Supreme Court, the European Court of Human Rights, or the Canadian Supreme Court. However, if the groups just got information about the rights of sex workers or just got information about a court could strike it down, then there was no statistically significant difference.
So what does your research tell us? It tells us that the public are receptive and influenced by decisions of courts that they respect. Is that what you're telling me?
This research shows is that, you know, at least say in this case in Norway, is that they can be influenced, or at least some voters can be influenced. And it's interesting in this case that you actually lose majority support for a particular piece of legislation.
Is it possible that the results in Norway would be different from the results in other countries? I'm wondering, Norwegians perhaps more, do they perhaps put more faith in judges and legal decisions than citizens of other countries. I'm thinking perhaps Americans who might regard the Supreme Court as a more inherently politicised beast than, say, equivalents in Northern Europe.
Absolutely, but I'd probably disagree with the example used. So, you know, Norwegians generally have a high trust in their institutions, and that's one of the features of Nordic countries. And I think that's why their level of support is pretty much consistent across the three very different types of courts. If you go across to Britain, then I don't think one would get the same results, and that's something to be tested. What we see, though, from another study is that, you know, the British have a much lower view, for example, of the European Court of Human Rights compared to their own court. So we wouldn't expect the same sort of shifts in public opinion in Britain. In fact, we might expect negative effects if the European Court of Human Rights intervenes on a sort of a political hot button issue. The interesting thing in the US is that the US Supreme Court consistently does better than other political institutions. You probably know, I mean, Congress only has a sort of a 10% favorability rating amongst the entire public of the US, whereas the Supreme Court gets up into the 50s and 60s in terms of its support. So even though it's a very politicized institution, it's generally well respected by the public. In fact, it's only Afro-Americans which have had a declining respect for the US Supreme Court. But I think if we then go to other places in the world, if we go to Kenya or to China or to Thailand, you're not going to find necessarily the same levels of respect if there's distrust generally in the courts.
Coming back to the hot button social issues, what do you think the courts can learn from this kind of research? How would they take it on board? How could they take it on board?
I think courts can learn a number of things from this research. The first is that they do have what we might call some symbolic power or attitudinal power, which they can use in certain cases. One might then think consequentially about how that is best used. And a good example comes from the Brown versus Board of Education decision of the US Supreme Court in 1954. And what Chief Justice Warren did was...
And that's a civil rights case.
It's a civil rights case. Basically found that segregation of schooling between white and Afro-American citizens was unconstitutional, violated the right to equal treatment. What Chief Justice Warren did was firstly work to get a consensus judgment. And his work in that direction has been proved to be quite wise in subsequent research, which shows that if people learn of a dissenting decision, they're less likely to change their mind. The second thing that he did was work to get a comprehensible judgment that the public could understand and ensure that the New York Times published the judgment in full. And so what he was trying to do, in a sense, was basically go over the heads of the state leaders, particularly in the South, and direct to the American public. Because they realised that to get compliance with the decision, they had to actually change public opinion on this issue. And so I think there's some lessons there, both historically and from the quantitative research, showing that if courts look at the different factors that influence the public response to their judgment, they may be able to have a positive role in this regard.
Associate Professor Malcolm Langford from the University of Oslo. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to technical producer Nick Mierisch. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.